Hello there. Welcome. Today is Thursday, December 22nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, an all-out manhunt underway to find the suspect in a deadly truck attack in Berlin.
He was put under surveillance by the German authorities in March.
The U.S. disputes claims by Russia about lack of communication. If you're waiting till the last minute, we've got some gift ideas for you. Also ahead, wild news coming out of Hollywood. It's all on today's International Edition. An intense manhunt is underway in Germany and across much of Europe for the chief suspect in Monday's deadly truck attack on a Christmas market in Berlin. He's said to be an asylum seeker in Germany and is armed and extremely dangerous. Joining me now for more on what we know is national security expert Jamil Jaffer. Jamil, what's the latest?
His asylum papers were found in the cab of the truck that was used in the incident.
What do we know about this man?
Anis Amri, 23-year-old Tunisian. He's used at least six different aliases, claimed to have been born in three different countries, Tunisia, Egypt, and Lebanon. Turns out he is, in fact, Tunisian. Left Tunisia about 7 years ago, went to Italy. He was leaving Tunisia apparently under a cloud. He'd been accused of armed robbery. Went to Italy, was there for a few years, and apparently she went to jail after he committed various crimes, apparently trying to burn down a school, was released from jail. The Italians were planning on deporting him to Tunisia. Apparently there was some hiccup, and he was ordered, he wasn't ultimately deported to Tunisia, but was ordered to leave Italy, ultimately ends up entering Germany near the border with Switzerland, and then, bounces around a little bit, starts off in one town, then goes to North Rhine-Westphalia, ultimately moves to Berlin in February of this year. He was put under surveillance by the German authorities in March. Apparently, they learned that he was trying to locate a weapon, a gun. The surveillance was ultimately called off in September. They did round up some of his friends, though, in November, including apparently a radical cleric, an Iraqi preacher affiliated with the Islamic State known as Abu Wala. And so the hunt for Amri heated up. They announced that he was a potential danger to the nation, to safety. And then after the Berlin attack, he was identified as a driver of the truck.
With the open borders in Europe, how is the spread of violence and terrorism to be contained?
Look, it's a hard problem for European authorities, to be sure. The open borders are part of the challenge. The bigger part of the challenge, honestly, is the ongoing conflict in Syria and the sort of fallings out of that conflict, the conflict that we have sort of stood by and watched happen with a great human death toll, and the spread of terrorism out of that region now into Europe, partly at times into the United States, not in nearly as big a way as it has been in Europe. But that day is coming, and, there have been a lot of people talking, Amri was a refugee, we need to tighten up our borders and the like. The real truth of the matter is that what we need to be doing is dealing with the problem that is ISIS, to be going after them in their home in Syria and making sure we're winning that conflict. And the truth is, for the past, 4 years or three, four years that we've been fighting this conflict, we haven't done a good job of that because we fundamentally have not been willing to commit to the fight. And so we need to commit to that fight and actually take the fight to the terrorists where they are and not wait for them to come to us, whether it's in Europe, in the West, or here in the United States.
But isn't part of it that really ISIS could change its colors, it could change its name, but if we don't get to the root of what's created it, that we will always have this problem?
Sure, but looking for root causes, trying to solve root causes, is a long-term problem. Right now, we have a very immediate problem, which is the growing threat of terrorism in the West, in Europe, and in the United States. And we've dealt pretty well with the problem of al-Qaeda. We have put al-Qaeda on the run. We've chased them down. We've run them down. And we've made it a lot harder for them to plan. We have fundamentally not done that with ISIS. To the contrary, we've allowed them to grow and grow in strength in the lands between Iraq and Syria. We've given them access to oil wealth. We've allowed them to maintain that access. And while we have taken some actions, we've really played the margins of this thing. And there's been good reason for that. We've been reluctant to go back into another ground war in the Middle East, as the president famously said, you're not going to drag me back into that. But the truth is, the results are what we're seeing today. We've seen massive suffering in Aleppo, and we've seen massive suffering now in Europe of terrorist attacks. And, America at some point has got to stop, watching paint dry and do something about these very real threats that are coming out of the Middle East.
Does this just make the case for the growing anti-refugee sentiment?
Well, look, to be sure, there are going to be people who are going to say this is part of the refugee problem, and we need to tighten our borders and the like. And there's no doubt we need to take a close look at people coming to the United States and ensure that we've vetted them appropriately. But the United States has had a long history of opening our nation to people from conflict zones, and we're not going to ever give that up. This is not about refugees. It's not about letting people in, or a certain kind of people, or a certain religion. What this is really about is the fact that we have not fundamentally confronted the threat that ISIS poses to us, and we haven't taken it seriously. Ever since they got their home in Iraq and Syria, we have essentially allowed them to. We put a little bit of pressure on them, but not nearly enough to stop them from conducting attacks abroad, both in Europe and in the United States. And if we do that and do that soon, that will be our failure. It's not about refugees. It's not about borders. It's about taking the fight to the terrorists where they are. We did that with Al-Qaeda. We need that with ISIS.
Lastly, Donald Trump is saying that the European attacks are just proof that he's on the right track as far as the need for Muslim screening. What do you say to that?
I think that our nation has long had a history of religious freedom. The notion that we should be screening people on the basis of their religion strikes me as absurd. To be sure, we should be careful about where the threat is coming from. We should screen people who are coming to this country, refugees or not, and we should make sure our borders are safe. But that is one thing. It's another thing to be saying we should screen people because of their religion. That's not what this country is based on. This country began as a home for people who had a disagreement with their state about their religion. If the question is, should we be more aggressive about determining who should and should not come in this country? Of course you should. At any time our national security is threatened, that's something that we're going to do. Should that be code for screening people based on their religion? Absolutely not. That is not what this country is based on, nor what it should be based on.
All right, Jamil Jaffer, national security expert with George Mason University. We certainly appreciate your perspective. U.S. officials expressed surprise over a Kremlin spokesman's comments that relations between Washington and Moscow are practically frozen. U.S. State Department spokesman John Kirby says the Kremlin official's assertion came just a day after a telephone conversation between U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. And on the same day that American and Russian military officers held a video conference to discuss flight safety over Syria.
I don't know exactly what to make of that comment. Obviously, we don't agree and have issues with Russia on a variety of issues, but the dialogue has not been broken. We talked yesterday about Secretary in his phone call with Foreign Minister Lavrov after their meeting in Syria and Moscow. The Defense Department acknowledged earlier today that they, too, held a deconfliction VTC, as they've been doing with respect to operations in Syria. So certainly on the major issues and the issues that matter most, I mean, there continues to be dialogue. So I'm just not sure what to make of his comment. That's certainly not reflective of the way we see communications between Moscow and Washington.
Well, U.S. officials do acknowledge significant differences with Russia, ranging from Moscow's backing of Syria's government in its brutal offensive against rebels to alleged Russian interference in the U.S. presidential election. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. The U.N. sets up a team to prepare Syrian war crimes charges. U.S. death sentences decline sharply as public attitudes shift. The Japanese prime minister will take a non-apology tour to Pearl Harbor. And South Sudan atrocities continue despite the president's call for dialogue. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Well, with less than a week now to go until Christmas, plenty of procrastinators out there panicking about what gifts to get for their loved ones. Reporter Chris Morris joins us now with some last-minute ideas. Hi, Chris.
One thing that you might want to do, especially if you know someone who's a road warrior, is sign them up for a service like CLEAR or TSA Pre. Now, that's going to cost anywhere from $85 to about $200 or so, but it'll save them a lot of time when they're going through their travels throughout the year. And they're going to think of you every time and thank you every time they go through that. Another good idea, now, if you're a family person, if you're someone whose family history is really important to them, there's a service called StoryWorth, and it's a narrative service. What they do is every week they will send a question to your gift recipient, say your grandparent, and ask them something like, who was your first crush? Or what personal expectations do you hold yourself to? Now, the person writes their answers down or records them audibly. And then at the end of the year, StoryWorth will put them together and bind them into a book for you to enjoy or hand down to future generations. That comes for a $79 flat rate. It's a really neat idea, and it's one that you can just order online and not have to worry about it.
Any specific last-minute gadget-type gifts for the gadget person in your life that just loves techie stuff?
Yeah, if you've got someone who's really into tech and you don't have time to run by and pick up the latest and greatest, there are a couple things you can do. First off, if they don't have an Amazon Prime membership, that's a great gift. It's $99, and not only do you get that free two-day shipping that everyone loves so much, but you also get access to over 2 million streaming songs, their music service. There's a very robust video streaming service like Netflix that's included in that $99. You'll also have unlimited online photo storage space, and you get early access to certain deals on Amazon. So that's one to consider. Also, if you've got someone who's a gamer and you don't have time to go by Best Buy or GameStop, or they were sold out of what you wanted, take a look on the online services for things like Xbox Live and PlayStation. You can buy those games digitally and sneak into the room when they're not looking, download it to their system. Or if they like to play on the PC, there's a service called Steam, which is the big digital distribution service for games on the PC, and you can gift games. Those range anywhere from $20 to $60.
Okay. So, Chris, a lot of people are really concerned about a lot of the tragedies and the suffering that are happening around the world and maybe want to try something different, maybe to give back. What would you say to people that just don't want to just buy a thing for someone?
I think one of the best things that you can do for that is giving back at this time of year is really what makes people feel good. So you can donate to a local charity or something that's important to you. And if you can't make up your mind, give someone a gift in the name of a group called Heifer International. They work to eliminate world hunger and poverty, and what they do is provide animals to villages, which help supply a variety of goods. I mean, sheep can provide clothing to a community as well as income when extra wool is sold at market. A goat can provide milk as well as additional income. Another option that you can have is these are your friends, these are your family. You know what causes are important to them. And so make a donation in their name. That could be to the American Cancer Society. That could be to the American Humane Society. Something like that. Find a cause that's important to them and help them fight for that cause.
Great, great suggestions. Thanks so much. Chris Morris, freelance journalist who writes for CNBC and Yahoo.com. Thank you so much for being with us and happy holidays. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
I'm Victor Beatty. Since 1942, the Voice of America has been a consistently reliable and authoritative source of news. Today, VOA remains committed to providing an accurate, objective, and comprehensive news product at the top of every hour, every day. We can be heard on your local affiliate or streamed on the web at voanews.com.
Jazz America!
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues now. We turn to We turn now to what's trending on social media today. We are joined by Michael Lippin. Michael, today's big topic focused on U.S. politics.
Hi, Lori, it is. It's all about a campaign phrase that President-elect Donald Trump used quite successfully in the final weeks before last month's election, the phrase, drain the swamp. It was his way of telling voters that if elected, he would seek to oust the alligators from the Washington swamp, with the alligators being the establishment figures whom he railed against as a candidate, accusing them of disastrous leadership of the country. So this phrase jumped back into the spotlight today because one of Trump's closest allies and advisors, former U.S. House Speaker Newt Gingrich, told National Public Radio in an interview that he's been told that Trump now disclaims it. Gingrich said Trump is in a different role now and maybe feels that as the next U.S. president, he should be, quote-unquote, more dignified than talking about alligators in swamps.
Oh, okay. Well, so what kind of reaction is that getting?
There has been a flood of tweets from the anti-Trump crowd, with one after another accusing Trump of breaking his promise and ridiculing his supporters for believing that he would actually drain the swamp. Here's a sample from user at MakeWayForTay. Drain the swamp? Another reminder that credulous, gullible Trump voters were fed lines they wanted to hear. How's that swamp smelling? And then this one from Diane Warren. Now that Trump has filled the swamp with vile reptiles like himself, he's decided to stop using the term drain the swamp. Now as for Trump, supporters have been tweeting about this too. Here's one from Deplorable Mike. It's amazing how much the left acts like Trump has been president for the last 8 years. Let him govern before you judge.
Okay, well, I understand we're now turning to our neighbor to the north. Why is a teenager in Canada one of the top world trends today?
That's a good question. He's a 17-year-old Argentinian-born teen pop singer and YouTube star who lives in a town near Toronto, Sebastian Olzanski. He's got 398,000 followers on Twitter. His handle is at SebTSB. And he has such a big influence on Twitter that he can tweet out a hashtag and make it trend worldwide in just minutes. Want to know how he does it?
Well, okay, sure.
Today, he tweeted out one of his favorite hashtags, hashtag selfie for Seb, and just as he's done in the past, he encouraged his legions of teenage girl fans to tweet him a selfie of themselves with the hashtag so that he would see them and then send them one of his trademark flirty replies, like, "You are extremely cute. Wow. No, you're adorable." Now, what teenage girl wouldn't want to get a message like that from a pop idol? Olzanski has said in the past that he spends several hours replying to as many fan tweets as he can, but recently acknowledged that thousands of desperate pleas still go unanswered. Lori?
All right, Michael, thanks so much. You can follow him at Michael_Lippin. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Turning now to the lighter side of the news, the latest from Hollywood, we're joined by Rare.com content editor Nicole Moschella. Just when we thought Sofia Vergara's custody battle over her embryos couldn't get any weirder, this happens.
Sofia Vergara is in a custody battle over two embryos that she and her ex-fiancé, Nick Loeb, created in 2013. These embryos are being housed at a clinic in California right now, and they are currently, the embryos, who are going by the names Isabella and Emma, are currently suing Sofia Vergara because they cannot access a trust that was set up for them for education and health care if they had been born. And Nick Loeb is also trying to gain custody of these embryos, and now he's trying to have them brought to Louisiana because Louisiana is traditionally a pro-life state, and because it's the only state in the United States where embryos are considered to have rights. So by bringing them to Louisiana, he could probably gain the custody. He hopes he could gain the custody. They would be brought from California to Louisiana by courier, and he could get the rights that way. But he had to back down and remove one of his lawsuits because a judge ordered him to identify women that he was previously with who have had abortions, and he didn't want to do that. So it's been kind of a weird
only in Hollywood
battle. Yeah, exactly. She's since moved on. She's married to that really attractive Joe from Magic Mike, and I'm sure she would love to close this chapter in her life, but it doesn't sound to me like it's going anywhere.
Wow. Crazy stuff. Well, we do have a feel-good story for the holidays. Looks like comedian Amy Schumer is really doing something nice.
Yes, Christmas came early for the Schumer family. This week, Amy Schumer came out on Instagram and said that she had purchased the family farm that her father lost when she was a child. He was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, and the family had to declare bankruptcy. So they, according to her, lost everything, and she was able to buy it all back. And so she posted old photos of herself playing in the cornfields and a really sweet image of her FaceTiming with her dad and telling him the big news that she was able to buy this family farm back again. So that's great news for her. Santa came early in that family.
Any reaction from the father?
Just looks really happy in the Instagram post. And I know that they have a very close relationship because the character of her father in the movie Trainwreck that she put out a few years ago is based off of her real-life dad. So I'm sure he's thrilled to have his farm back.
Most definitely. Rare.com content editor Nicole Moschella, thanks so much. And have a great holiday. Well, in the new sci-fi film, passengers, people on Earth are on a 120-year trip to colonize a new planet, but something goes wrong on the way. Scientists say while much of the movie is a work of fiction, there's some real science behind many of the ideas in the movie. VOA's Elizabeth Lee in Los Angeles explores what they are.
In the movie, passengers, humans hibernate for a 120-year voyage to a distant planet for a new life.
We woke up 90 years too soon.
Finding a habitable planet is not so far-fetched for Tiffany Kataria, a NASA scientist who studies planets that orbit another star, or exoplanets.
The ultimate goal of studying exoplanets is to really find an Earth twin, to find some other planet out there that's Earth-like that maybe eventually we could colonize one day and explore.
In the movie, the passengers travel on a rotating spaceship to create gravity. The idea is not just science fiction, says aerospace engineer John Bradford.
So that's one of the main ways we're going to mitigate some of the challenges and things that come out in microgravity environment, damage to the human body in terms of bone demineralization and muscle atrophy. Having this artificial gravity solves those problems, and rotating it is the best way to do it, I think.
As for hibernating in space, that's what Bradford's company, SpaceWorks Enterprises, is researching with the hope that it could be used for human flight to Mars. One of the possible effects of spending time in space and long-term microgravity is intracranial pressure, which impairs an astronaut's vision. Bradford says that's something hibernation or human status can help, among other benefits.
Actually, cooling down the body, reducing the metabolism, reduces that intracranial pressure. It's one of the treatments here on Earth. We reduce the amount of food they need, amount of oxygen. We can put them in a very small space, as you see here.
Bradford says his company would first start human status for 2 weeks.
That 2 weeks is within current medical technology. It's limited data set, but that has been done before. But ultimately, to get the full benefits, we want to be able to go to 5 or 6 months. And, you know, that will take years, you know, maybe 15 years or so, 20 years to really fully understand all the impacts on the crew. But for the shorter stay and the shorter duration, these 2 week cycles, you know, we're optimistic we could be ready to support the first missions to Mars. So we just got to convince NASA.
As for human space flights beyond Mars and our solar system, that's where science ends and the fiction begins.
So the closest planet we know of that's actually, it's actually close to an Earth mass. It's called Proxima Centauri b. Proxima Cent is 4.2 light years away, and so that's about 25 trillion miles from here. The Juno spacecraft is orbiting Jupiter at 1,000 miles per hour. And so relative to Jupiter, but if we think about that same spacecraft getting maybe a gravity assist and going to Proxima Centauri b, that would take at that same speed, you know, tens of thousands of years. So really, you know, the technology still needs to make that leap, I think, to be able to achieve light speed travel or close to light speed travel.
It may take years of technology to catch up to the imagination, but audiences can still experience the excitement of space travel by going to movie theaters. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Los Angeles.
There's a reason we woke up early.
If you doubt the speed at which the world is changing, just take a look at the digital media. In the last 20 years, the introduction of mobile and internet technology has spawned breathtaking advances in the sharing of information and commerce. Today, an estimated 1/4 of the Earth's population uses the services of the internet. 2/3 of us now own a mobile phone. But these advances into the digital age have been met with problems. Problems like state censorship, hackers, and identity theft, to name just a few. The Voice of America wants to know how the digital world has transformed your life. Or have they? We'd like you to tell us your story by writing or sending videos to our website, Twitter, or Facebook page. Find out more by visiting us at our webpage at voanews.com and then click on Digital Frontier. Tell your story and share it with the world through VOA's Digital Frontier.
I'm James Butte, host of Daybreak Africa. Join me every weekday mornings at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of the show through our listeners' mail segment. Just send your views to daybreakafrica@voanews.com or call us on 202-205-9942. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
Under its Rewards for Justice program, the U.S. State Department has announced it is increasing to $25 million its reward offer for information leading to the location, arrest, or conviction of ISIL leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, also known as Ibrahim Awad Ibrahim Ali al-Badri and Abu Dua. Al-Baghdadi is the senior leader of the terrorist organization, the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, also known as ISIL or Daesh. Protecting the homeland and the American people is the top counterterrorism priority for the United States. Just as military efforts have been intensified against ISIL, the United States is increasing the means available to gain information on ISIL leadership and bring them to justice. In June 2014, ISIL seized control of portions of Syria and Iraq, self-declared a so-called Islamic caliphate, and named al-Baghdadi as caliph. In recent years, ISIL has gained the allegiance of jihadist groups and radicalized individuals around the world, and has inspired terrorist attacks in the United States. Under al-Baghdadi, ISIL has been responsible for the deaths of thousands of civilians in the Middle East, including the brutal murder of numerous civilian hostages from Japan, the United Kingdom, and the United States. The group also has enabled or directed terrorist attacks beyond the borders of its self-declared caliphate. In 2011, the United States named Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi a specially designated global terrorist under Executive Order 13224. He was also sanctioned by the United Nations Security Council, ISIL Al-Qaeda Sanctions Committee. At that time, al-Baghdadi was the leader of al-Qaeda in Iraq, which ultimately morphed into ISIL. If you have information on Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, contact the Rewards for Justice Office via email at no2daesh@rewards4justice.co, by phone at 1-800-877-3927, or by mail at Rewards for Justice, Washington, D.C., 20520-0303, USA. All information will be kept strictly confidential. Since its inception in 1984, the Rewards for Justice program has paid in excess of $125 million to more than 80 people who provided actionable information that helped bring terrorists to justice or prevented acts of international terrorism worldwide. You can follow the Rewards for Justice program on Twitter at twitter.com/rewards4justice.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.
is 4.